Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your two hosts, Katie Halper.
That, I guess, makes me the other one. I'm Matt Taibbi.
Welcome, Matt. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome to Useful Idiots, coronavirus week whatever edition.
Yeah.
How many weeks have we been in quarantine now?
I don't know, a couple months?
A couple months. I'm strangely, like, not tired of it yet.
Really?
I mean, I'm kind of a misanthrope anyway, so I don't really, you know, see, you know, as I think it was Sartre once said, hell is other people. So I'm not quite freaking out yet. Yourself?
So you're, like, excited that people are dropping off?
No. I'm not like, you know, reveling in the deaths of all those people. I'm just, you know, the fact that I'm not seeing so many is strangely not affecting my psyche negatively. And yourself, you're doing well?
I am. I'm also appreciating having some dogs around. I think I'm a more social person than you are. But I'm around other people, family and a family friend, which makes a big difference, the family friend and not just family. Because it kind of prevents me from totally devolving and regressing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have to have somewhat of a game face.
Right. Well, none of us have gone completely openly insane yet. So that's these are all good signs. So that leaves it. It makes it possible for us to continue to do the show. And
nice segue,
right? That was good. So let's, I guess, just move into the four food groups, which begins, as always, with Democrats Suck. So what do we have for Democrats Suck this week?
For Democrats Suck, Dan, if we could just go to the videotape to see one of our two favorite living Cuomos.
When we are reopening schools, let's open a better school and let's open a smarter education system. And I want to thank the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We'll be working with them on this project. Bill Gates is a visionary in many ways, and his ideas and thoughts on technology and education he's spoken about for years. But I think we now have a moment in history where we can actually incorporate and advance those ideas.
Okay, so I'm always suspicious of any Bill Gatesian projects or Gates Foundation projects. I'm not an education policy expert, but you know who is Diane Ravitch.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to just quote her and her response to the Bill Gates's tendencies. She said that she distinguishes between reformers and disruptors in education, and she's writing about Bill Gates in this context. I call them disruptors, not reformers. Reformers have historically called for more funding, better trained teachers, desegregation, smaller class sizes. The disruptors, however, banked on a strategy of testing, competition, and punishment, which turned out to be ineffective and harmful. So I thought it was interesting and cool that Ravitch, this education scholar and expert, that she called him a disruptor. Because I just think that's so on brand. Like, that's exactly the word that Gates and other Gates supporters would use to describe themselves. Because they like all that, like, edgy nomenclature.
Well, creative destruction, right, is the word that sort of free market advocates like to use.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, so it's just a, you know, a kind of scary combination. Also, Gates is a FOE. Friend of Epstein, or was a friend of Epstein, I suppose. They hung out a little bit, so another red flag. But he's just, like, has a very neoliberal, privatizing, core curriculum, standardized testing type of education model that I think is not helpful and is punitive. So
I just don't like his products all that much. And I just hate having to pay for Word every time I get a computer.
Yeah.
Like, really? It's just non-user-friendly products.
It really is not user-friendly. In fact, I think all parents or people over a certain age should be banned from using them, because I feel like I would save a lot of time and heartache if my dad were on Mac and not PC.
Mm-hmm.
Because like you said, it's not user-friendly. And the way my dad responds to tech issues is as if he's the victim of a pogrom or something. Like, it's so personalized and so such an injustice.
Right. So basically, Cuomo wanted to use the opportunity of this crisis to reinvent education, and with the help of the Gates Foundation.
Right. It's kind of shock doctrine-ish, as Naomi Klein describes it.
Once again, we're not letting a crisis go, good crisis go to waste. So, yeah. All right. That's good. So that's a Democrat suck. For Republican suck, I got Kelly Loeffler again. And it just came out. This story just came out in the Times today. Loeffler got a lucrative parting gift from public company en route to the Senate. And by today, I guess by the time this comes out, it's going to be a few days from now. But this is early in the week. The story came out that... you know, in addition to the earlier scandal, which to remind listeners, it came out that a bunch of senators and members of Congress had sort of panic sold stocks after they were briefed about the seriousness of the coronavirus. So they essentially, you know, got out ahead of all of us with inside information and cashed in while there was all this public reassurance that things were all right. If you might remember that Loeffler was one of the biggest targets of the scandal because her husband is the chairman of the stock exchange, Jeff Sprecher. I love that name.
Yeah.
They sold about, I think it was $3 million worth of securities after a briefing that she had in late January. So there was already a lot of scandal around Loeffler surrounding, you know, taking financial advantage of this crisis. And now, like, to put salt in the wound, the Times is doing this story that basically said that as she was entering the Senate, the Intercontinental Exchange, which is, the parent company of the NYSE, that they gave her, like, a $9 million stock award. Basically, like, it's a going away present to go off to public service. And here's the quote was amazing. This is Josh King, a spokesman for the Intercontinental Exchange, said the awards to Mrs. Loeffler reflected what he said was her instrumental long-term role at the company. Quote, we admire Kelly's decision to serve her country in the U.S. Senate and did not want to discourage that willingness to serve, Mr. King said in a statement. In other words, we want to make sure that you're not going to decide against going into the Senate for financial reasons.
Right.
Here's $9 million,
right,
which should tide you over until you get back into the welcoming embrace of the Intercontinental Exchange.
Right. You don't want someone to not go into government for lack of $9 million.
Exactly. I mean, that would be a tragedy that this couldn't be remedied. That's a pretty bad one. This on top of the Burr story, it is a bipartisan thing because there are some Democrats who did some of the same stuff, but these two are particularly horrible. And this one, I think there's going to be probably more blowback about this the further we get into this crisis, because Loeffler is voting for a rescue package that is going directly to propping up the NYSE. So, you know, well, not directly, more or less directly, right? They're flooding Wall Street with money through the Fed, and a lot of that money is being used to create liquidity that's going back into the stock market, that's keeping prices artificially high and keeping everybody in the money. So, you know, that looks pretty bad. NYSE gives $9 million to a senator who votes for a rescue package that helps the NYSE. I mean, that's about as clear cut as that sort of payola politics gets. So
they're paying it forward, Matt.
Paying it forward. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that's my Republican suck this week.
Yeah. So should I go to my Isn't That Weird?
Mm-hmm.
We got an interesting story. And if we could go to the videotape, Dan. Spoiler alert, it's someone allegedly licking hands before touching food.
And the Sumter Sheriff's Department asking for your help tonight to identify this woman seen on video licking her hands and then touching items inside a sub shop. It happened this past Monday at the Substation 2 on Peach Orchard Road near Shaw Air Force Base. In the video, you see the woman lick her hands several times and then proceed to touch items around the store. If you know who this woman is, call Crime Stoppers at 1-888-CRIME-SC.
So we now know who the woman allegedly is, Shaneer Holiday. She's 38, and she's facing charges, including unlawful malicious tampering with food and breach of peace. Again, she licked her hands and coughed before opening freezer doors and touching food at an IGA grocery store, police said Sunday. She also did this in the dry food section, and they heard about this from a call about her, and they were able to find her in the parking lot. And they identified her and determined she matched the suspect's description. Surveillance footage showed that what she'd done, according to the official account. She also, I guess, has a record, a substation record. She's accused of a previously reported incident in which a woman at a Substation 2 sandwich restaurant allegedly licked coins before putting them in the tip jar and licked her hands before giving the cashier money.
Wait, she's the same person who did that?
Yes. It's her thing.
She's a licker.
Yeah, she's a licker.
So
yeah.
Wait, and this happened before the COVID crisis or the other one?
That's a really good question, actually. I don't know. We should look into that.
Well, regardless, I don't know how I feel about her being arrested for this. I mean, it's gross. No, I mean, it's just,
right.
It's a little bit subjective, it feels like to me. I'm sure the way they found her is they found the one person who bought a Champion brand pantsuit.
I was going to say, it's an impressive jumpsuit or sports tracksuit. What is that? I can't tell. I think it's a tracksuit. Are there two different garments? Yeah, it must be, right?
But it's Champion.
Champion, the brand.
Yeah, exactly. Which, there's probably only four people in America who have bought that product, I would think. So probably pretty easy to track down that person. But but wow, yeah. No, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, is that going to be a thing now? Are we going to start prosecuting people who cough in public?
Intentional, right? I mean, I feel like your civil libertarian antenna are probably going off right now, right? Correct, Matt? Am I right?
I'm just a little, it's a little different than some other things that are in this ballpark, right? They had some debates about this, you know, in previous health crises. But this feels like it's a little bit more subjective to me, but you know, it's gross. Don't get me wrong. I just worry about it a little bit.
Well, she apparently, I like this part. Apparently, reading at Fox 5NY.com. Deputy said the woman exited the store before the workers were done making her food and told them she will be back. Deputies did not find her at the shop when they arrived after the incident. She was put on a trespass notice for all substation sandwich shops and charged with aggravated breach of peace and food tampering. She's being held at a detention center on a $100,000 bond. She's also issued a violation citation for the state's home or work order and was ordered to be tested for the novel coronavirus. That's actually maybe good. Maybe this is a good thing because maybe this is her way of getting tested for free.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I've changed my mind about this. I don't know. Whatever they did is probably appropriate. It's pretty weird. It's interesting that they have a protocol for substation sandwich shops.
Right. So, I mean, why should she have a like restraining order or whatever the equivalent is against that store in particular? What if she targets like
yeah, she could go in anywhere.
Or, yeah. What if Wendy's next or McDonald's or
Baskin Robbins?
That would suck because I really like their ice cream.
Really?
Oh yeah. I really, you know, we've talked about ice cream before and I don't know if you remember, Matt, do you remember any of my favorites?
I don't.
Oh my God, I remember one of yours is strawberry, which I'm okay with. I find problematic. Mint chocolate chip. And one day I was really craving mint chocolate chip ice cream and I went into like three Baskin Robbins and they didn't have it. And then the third one I went to, the guy, there was like at least two servings worth of mint chocolate chip ice cream at the bottom of the barrel. And the guy tried to deny me it. And I was like, what do you mean? It's right there. And he even like pantomimed his inability to do it by like going like this, but not even reaching down. He'd even straighten his arm. It was all like a bent arm, not even any effort. And I was like, no, there's some down there. And then he finally did it. And I was happy.
Actually, I called the guy and told him to do that to you.
Yeah,
when
you
came in. Yeah. Like, just pretend you can't, you just barely can't reach it.
I know.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah. That is terrible. All right. Yeah. So cereal liquor, that is weird. Isn't that weird? That's weird.
I think, isn't that weird? Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that terrible? I got two things I'm going to do fairly quickly. One is a story. Dan, if we could bring this up. Coronavirus researcher killed in suspected murder-suicide. So if you can see the headline, a University of Pittsburgh researcher on the verge of a breakthrough of understanding the coronavirus was found shot dead in his home. According to a report, Bing Liu, 37, was allegedly killed inside his Pittsburgh area townhouse by a man who then went outside to his car and shot himself. So it's a New York Post story, which Katie actually sent to me. And the reason, what's amazing is the coincidence. I had already seen this story because I have basically a Google alert for what I call comma self stories.
Right.
So anytime there are murder suicides, I had a friend who randomly used to collect headlines that say something comma self. And this one was on there, even though it's not in the headline, but there were a whole bunch last week, you know, prominent Madison dentist kills ailing wife comma self. Father kills adult son, comma, self in New England. There's a whole bunch of them. Yeah, man kills neighbor's friend, then self in Treasure Beach neighborhood. So in the midst of looking through all those, I had seen this one, which has an additional news angle because it's like horrible. Right. Additionally, because the he might have also been on the verge of finding the cure for coronavirus when he became a comma self headline.
Makes me happy about the other ones almost. I mean, not happy, but it's not fair to the other ones because it's so bumped to the bottom of the barrel, speaking of Baskin-Robbins, because, I mean, those are sad, but they don't kill other people the way that murder, suicide involving someone on the brink of a cure.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So we're now in like genres of news stories where you have to have multiples of horribleness to even qualify as horrible, right? So just a regular old murder, you know, comma self murder suicide, that's like a page 11 story, you know, maybe in a local newspaper. But it has, if the person who's comma selfed was on the verge of curing coronavirus or whatever it was, you know, that might get you all the way to page 2 in the current environment.
That really, that raises the bar.
Right?
That throws off the curve.
It throws off the curve, we're not flattening the curve here.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, nice pun.
But somebody's got to come up with a horribleness equation. I remember they did those statistics in the early 90s about how many people in Africa have to be slaughtered in order to equal the column inches of one Upper East Side murder victim. There's got to be some kind of algorithm you could do to figure out how much horribleness you need to actually. Yeah.
Except that's a good equation. Ours is not problematic. Our equation is just literally based on lives saved as opposed to colonialism and racism.
Right. Yes, exactly. Well, we're measuring something different.
By curve, I meant like a grading on a curve.
Oh, I see. Yes.
I meant like it raises the bar, but you're right. It also relates to the flattening of the curve. Right.
Right. And then just quickly, and then this is another story that Katie sent me. Dan, if we could pull this story up. Elon Musk's partner Grimes reveals meaning behind baby's name.
I knew you'd be triggered by this story.
I am kind of triggered.
Yeah. So Tesla CEO Elon Musk and singer Grimes have welcomed a baby boy.
So when somebody asked the baby's name, Musk replied, I can't even describe what it is. He replied X, and then it's like that Aeon Flux symbol, like AE. Which apparently is an Elven symbol. And then it's A12 Musk is the name.
Right.
So the name began trending on Twitter. And then people are asking, can anyone enlighten me on how you pronounce this name? And so this prompted Grimes,
who's a singer who confirmed the pregnancy in January.
She explained that the X stands for the unknown variable. The AE is the Elven spelling of AI, which is shorthand for artificial intelligence and translates to love in several languages, such as Japanese. And that the 32-year-old star then shared that as a part of her son's name is a reference to the couple's favorite aircraft, A-12, a precursor to the SR-17. No weapons, no defenses, just speed, great in battle, but non-violent. He added, I don't know what the fuck that means. Do you know what that means?
No, I mean, I guess it's a pacifist plane.
It's great in battle?
Yeah, how is it great in battle without being violent? I guess it transports people to be in battle, but doesn't actually kill people on the way.
Grimes concluded the message by revealing that the A in the name also represents Archangel, which she described as her favorite song. I don't even know that song. Do you know that song?
No.
Part of me, I don't know. I don't know how you feel about this. I'm a huge Prince fan. So, you know, as a, right. as a fan of somebody who had a literally an unpronounceable symbol as his name for most of his career, I'm okay with having a weird name. Everybody has a right to do that. But yeah. I wonder a little bit about the kid who doesn't have a choice in that name.
Right. But. Yeah. The person has the right to choose that for themselves. It's almost like being raised by a Christian Scientist or something.
Right.
Like, let them grow up to be adults before they decide to make the terrible decision not to take medication.
Right, right. Yeah. Or like being in the Heaven's Gate cult or something like that and being, right. you know, being given the name like Borp or something. Right. You know, like, I guess it's okay. I don't know.
But speaking of equations, like, is there an equation? Because I feel like Prince is so incredibly talented and was so incredibly talented and unique that it kind of justifies a weird name. I feel like you have to have achieved some stuff in life before you get to be, if not right. just painful pretentiousness.
Right, right. Yeah, like Prince was so awesome that even his insistence on calling himself by a name that you literally can't right. pronounce, even that came out as not being somehow pretentious.
Right.
I think
so exceptional.
Yeah, exactly. Like it actually kind of worked a little bit. But in this case, I don't know what we're really talking about here. This is a kid who's going to go to school. What's your name? You know,
the baby currently.
Do you have 5 minutes? I'll explain
right,
it to
yeah,
you. You know,
exactly.
And here's an Elven dictionary.
Yeah.
And I don't know. You were correct. I was triggered by this story.
I need to be really upset by it. At first, yeah. I was like, that should be, isn't that weird? And I was like, no, for Matt Taibbi, that should be an isn't that terrible. Yeah. But so wait, if Prince is the artist formerly known as Prince, right?
Right.
Then this baby is like the baby currently known as unpronounceable.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
brackets.
Right. As the unknown variable minus AI plus a plane that's fast in battle,
yeah.
but is defensive only.
Yeah.
It's okay though. You know, I mean, it's like the billionaire version of Dances with Wolves or something like that. Right.
right?
You yes. know, is born with money. I guess that's what,
yeah,
that's
exactly, right. right. Yes.
That's the Native American
that's
name.
That's how you pronounce it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Is born with money. Anyway, you're right. I was triggered. So, but probably on balance, less horrible than the murder self suicide of somebody who was about to solve all of the Earth's problems. So, yeah.
Maybe if it hadn't had that extra kick at the end, it would have been equivalent, but he really bumped it up again with the murder suicide or really raised, you know,
right.
made it impossible
right.
to reach those heights, even with a plane.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what else do we have this week that we want to talk about?
Well, I mean, Trump is like, you know, saying that Corona is basically over. We're reopening the country. We can talk about that with our guests probably. But I did think that there was an interesting story. I don't know if you've seen this. There's been kind of like a Bay of Pigs 2.0 that, much like the Bay of Pigs, failed. And instead of being in Cuba this time, it was in Venezuela. And it was apparently the plan was to kidnap Maduro and overthrow his government. But it didn't work out very well. And it was coordinated by this guy who's very interesting. He's Canadian, again, which is always kind of inherently.
We have a theme going in this show.
I know, I was going to say. And then you throw in Elon Musk and you got the whole Commonwealth. But his name is Jordan Goudreau, by the way. So there have been some mercenaries arrested after this raid in Venezuela. But if we could just show that I have two videos about this guy, Jordan Goudreau, who's claimed credit for this. For organizing this failure.
At 1700 hours, a daring amphibious raid was launched from the border of Colombia deep into the heart of Caracas. Our men are continuing to fight right now. Our units have been activated in the south, west, and east of Venezuela. Commander Nieto is with me, is co-located, and Commander Sakaya is on the ground now fighting.
For those who are just listening and not watching, he is sitting. Well, standing with his, is there a name for this, Matt? They're both standing with one leg bent.
It's like stitting.
sitting. Yeah. They're standing on a leg and they have their other leg is bent at 90 degrees and then their foot is on something elevated. So it's like they're about to do a lunge or something.
Groucho Marx does this in one of his movies. I think it's A Night at the Opera.
Okay.
But we'll have to look that up. But yeah, they're a half standing, half crouching pose. Yeah, very manly.
Yeah, very manly. And the guy who he's next to, which is a apparently retired Venezuelan National Guard captain, he's just sitting there and he's making like the most amazing face. How would you describe the face? It's almost like duck face.
It looks like someone shoved five rotten lemons in his mouth.
Yeah.
And told him that, and then like stapled his lips together.
Right. And told him to look butch at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And these guys, incidentally, they both look like they just escaped from the trying on section and the Gap.
And then if we can see this other video, this guy, Jordan Goudreau, and he runs this like private security firm. So if you go to his website, something really interesting is going to happen, which is that you're going to see his mouth moving, but there's just music in the background. So Matt, we'll have to describe the video for people who are only listening. So it's basically a video that looks like it's shot on very expensive footage. And you see this guy shirtless in almost every part. He's doing stuff like boxing, kickboxing. Here he is getting out of a fancy car. Here he is running around with his dog.
His extremely scary looking pit bull, which is his companion, clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the company he runs is Silvercore. And it's, let me just read the really weird description of it. It was founded by with one purpose in mind. We provide governments and corporations with realistic and timely solutions to irregular problems. They advise corporations, governments worldwide, operating in over 50 countries and based in the Space Coast of Florida. By the way, anything based in Florida tends to be reactionary and wants to overthrow, especially populist or leftist governments in Latin America.
No, come on. No, we're gonna smear all of Florida with that brush.
Saying anything security-ish, let's say based in Florida. Is that fair? You're right. I am smearing them, but what I feel like you'd be good at this, Matt. What is the equation? Again, we keep coming up with these equations, but like what's the any blank based in Florida? What? Any security company?
Yeah. Any private security military contractor? Yeah. That's probably. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. As a leading global provider of crisis leadership, risk management, complex project leadership, and project integration, Silvercore USA provides services to commercial and government clients around the world. Its dynamic planning and precise solutions include a range of diverse services. These include crisis plans and consulting, risk management, special projects, and critical infrastructure risk analysis. At Silvercore, our priority is to achieve veritable success for our clients.
So, he apparently was inspired. He said he was inspired by Alexander the Great, who quote, struck deep into the heart of the enemy at the Battle of Gaugamela in 331 BC.
It was a good year for Alexander.
And apparently, did you catch this detail that the Maduro government had some fun talking about who they busted, that they arrested a pair of quote unquote professional mercenaries named Luke Denman and Aaron Berry, who carried ID cards for Silvercore. And Maduro equated their alleged efforts to overthrow his government to, quote, playing Rambo and playing hero. And it turns out that at least one of these people was carrying an airsoft rifle when they went in to take on, remember, it's 62 people, and they took on an army of 40,000, and one of them was carrying a fake gun.
Yeah, what is that? I'm really ignorant about that, but what is that?
An airsoft rifle is like something you would use, gun enthusiasts can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is something you'd use like in a military training scenario, I'm pretty sure. It's not, they hurt, I think, when you get hit by
it. It's like paintball, kind of?
Something like, it's like a step up from paintball, maybe? I don't know. But certainly not lethal. And so I guess they wanted to make their odds even a little bit worse, since I guess 40,000 versus 62 was not good enough. You know, 40,000 against 61 and one with an airsoft rifle. So these dopes failed. And now they're going to be made sport of by the the Venezuelan government. Is it clear yet what's going to happen to these?
No.
I'm just trying to imagine the meeting where a bunch of people sat around the table and said, this is going to work.
Well, apparently Guaido, I mean, it sounds like Guaido's plans in Venezuela in general. And Guaido is, of course, like the shadow president of Venezuela, who tried to take over and establish call himself the president. Trump, of course, also called him the president and had him at the State of the Union. Big failure, though. Big fail, the guy, Guaido. And apparently they had an arrangement, but then they canceled the arrangement. But Jordan went ahead anyway. What's up with really weird Canadian Jordans who have weird issues about, like, masculinity?
You mean like Jordan? You're going to make a Jordan Peterson reference
here?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
I don't know how much this has to do with Jordan Peterson. This is
No, I'm just looking for the thread.
Right. Yeah. The thread is like, hyper-masculine, guys who have masculinity issues,
right?
Who spend too much time with each other and have read too many Tom Clancy novels and think that they can engineer their way out of a political dilemma with some high-flying, daring, covert operation. And when has something like this ever worked?
Right.
I'm trying to remember. This recalls the effort to rescue the hostages in Iran, although that, you can understand that one a little bit more because they weren't literally trying to overthrow a government.
Right. They were trying to rescue people. Right.
Right. But the absurdity of this is off the charts.
You see, there was something to the Canadian Jordan theory, though.
How so?
Masculinity, sending men off to do stupid things. I assume some kind of drug rehab stint is in the near future for Jordan. He said he was the organizer. They're working with me. Those are my guys.
I hate to come back to this, but it just really, this situation just reeks of cocaine, right? This is one of these things where, you're having a meeting and everybody's tossing the ideas around, and then the two guys run into each other in the restroom afterwards, and they're like, you had some really great ideas back there. Like, that's...
But then they're like, wait, you actually did that?
Yeah, I know. Dude, you actually did that shit?
Right.
Like, that's when you want to, you hope you come down before you go on and do anything. But God, this is the thing. If you poll Americans and you ask them, which group of people do you have the highest degree of trust in? Like, they have no trust in the media for absolutely good reasons. They have no trust in Congress. They have very little trust in almost every other institution. But the military, there is still a relatively high degree of trust.
Right.
In the military in this country. And there's a reason for that, which is that the people who actually like serve in regular military, battalions, they are very good at doing what they're told, and they build things. They're practiced, they're trained. It's the people who are a level up, though, in the military hierarchy, who are making like strategic decisions and or contracting decisions, who are completely insane and incompetent. If you want to talk about the Army Corps of Engineers, would you trust them to build a dam in your neighborhood? Absolutely. Right. But it's just unbelievable that they would try something like this.
We should call them. We should come up for a term for this genre of person, which is a Jordan. Like, what is Jordan?
A Jordan?
Yeah.
Right. Right. So this is like a Contra Karen thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Jordan.
Yeah. Okay, Jordan. Right. Like, whenever someone announces something that reveals some weird issues with masculinity and something that won't work, but that a lot of hyped up men will follow and support. Okay, Jordan.
Right. Right. So if you're posting videos of yourself running shirtless with your pit bull.
Right.
Like, okay, Jordan. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Jordan. Yeah. Also, it's the weirdest part of that video is that he's talking and looking at the camera, but there's music over it at certain parts. And like, who made that editing fail? I want a lip reader to tell us what he was saying, because maybe it's not an editing fail. Maybe it's a good damage control, because maybe who knows what he was saying? Like, maybe he was giving away secrets.
Yeah, he was telling us where Jimmy Hoffa was buried.
Yeah, right.
Can I just say, I'm kind of surprised that this isn't a bigger story.
I think it's because it's so embarrassing to the United States, and it's such great PR for Maduro.
I mean, like, what are the headlines in other countries? Like, U.S. steps on own dick.
Again. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, like massive U.S. face plant. U.S. massive face plant. Like, I mean, right. I don't even know what the headline would
U.S. be. Colon, sorry about your penis.
Right. But also, those two guys are going to have an interesting future as the, like, in dictionaries next to douchebag, they're going to have the sort of like the line art versions of their faces.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? I mean, where do you go from releasing self-worshipping videos of yourself running on a beach shirtless with your and jump punching into a heavy bag with like jujitsu mitts on before you go launching a failed amphibious mission into Venezuela with an airsoft rifle? They wouldn't have even thought of that in like the movie Step Brothers. Like that's yeah, like prestige worldwide dumb kind of a thing.
Yeah,
right?
It's almost like, I'm wondering, I mean, it's something like if I were Maduro, I would have like paid for that as a PR thing. But
right,
he didn't have to, because the U.S. has such a, they really have such a great record of like totally missing the mark with, especially in Latin America.
Well, normally when we're accomplishing our objectives, we're just using brute violence and economic terrorism and all those other good things. This is different. You're right. If Maduro had called a big PR firm, if he had called Burson Marsteller, for instance, and said, "Hey, I've got $50 million. What can you do for me that would make me look good and make Americans look like total goobers?"
Right.
Like this is what they would probably come up with. That's probably about as much as that would cost to send 62 idiots into your country with fake weapons. But yeah, hilarious story. And yeah, unfortunately, because we're in the middle of a transformative worldwide disaster, will not get the attention it deserves.
I know.
Probably.
Well, what we can do is we can try to, you know how Keith Olbermann used to do that thing? Like, it's been 27 days since George
Bush declared
mission accomplished. We should be like, it's been 27 days since Jordan Gondreau.
Goudreau, right?
Goudreau. Yeah, why the hell can't I say his name?
So it's been two days. AJ after Jordan. All right. Well, what else we have going on in the world this week?
Well, we got some exciting news out of New York State, where a federal judge ordered on Tuesday that New York State hold its canceled Democratic primary in June, which places Senator Bernie Sanders and other former 2020 candidates back on the ballot. And this was thanks to a case lawsuit filed by, do you know who? Do you guys know who?
No. Who?
Yang.
Oh,
this is,
right.
This is a useful idiots influenced, and really this should have been called Useful Idiots v. Board of Elections. Because I don't know if Andrew Yang would have had the confidence and gumption to do this had he not gotten that very important Useful Idiots bump that we gave him.
You think we're the ones who pushed him over the line?
I think so, yeah. To give him that confidence, that along with how many billions of dollars he has.
So what does this mean exactly with this? So this the primary is going to happen? Does that have
done,
any?
Yeah. Delayed, but there. Happening, but delayed.
Are you going to vote in it?
I'm really agnostic. I don't know whether to vote for Yang.
Yeah, right, right. What a cliffhanger about who you're going to vote for. Yeah.
Well, there are other candidates that are involved, and I have to consider all of them and see what of their policies I like, and I'm not sure. I will say that Andrew Yang coming in person versus Bernie only on the phone, and not just only on the phone, but only on the phone as in no video. I can't say that doesn't have some effect on my assessment of the candidates.
Well, I mean, look, it's like an Agatha Christie mystery, right? Like there are just so many choices. It's going to be really, really difficult to predict. The big question is whether Biden's going to get his 1,991 delegates. And, you know, we'll see how that all, I mean, it might end up playing into Biden's hands, actually, to have all these elections. Anything else we have?
I have one thing, which is, you know, we do stone moments. This is not a stone moment per se, but it makes me feel like I'm stoned because, dudes, do you guys know about this? Dan, maybe you're too young for this to mean anything for you. Matt, you know Kurt Loder, right?
Yeah, from MTV.
MTV. And you know he was at Rolling Stone before then?
I didn't.
Yeah, he was a big deal at Rolling Stone. How old do you think he is? He just had a birthday. Don't look at the document. How old do you think he is?
65.
He just turned 75.
Wow. Seriously?
Yes. Isn't that weird?
He's older than my parents. That's crazy.
I don't know why. Like, this is one of those moments where I feel very connected to humanity because everyone on Twitter was freaking out about it.
Huh.
Like, he shouldn't be that old.
Right.
He should be like maybe 65, maybe 60, maybe 55, something along those lines. I don't know what this is based on exactly, but it's a vibe.
Yeah, he's one of those people who, I guess, well, because he was in a sort of youth-centric media vehicle, you thought he was younger than he was.
I guess, yeah.
Maybe he's like an undead supernatural creature, right? Like, he's like a Highlander thing. There's actually been a Kurt Loder in every generation through the centuries, since dating back to 11th century Scotland or something like
right.
that. If we go back and look, we're gonna find portraits of them everywhere.
I guess you can't go back into the Rolling Stone office, but you could like look around and sneak around and see if you find anything.
Yeah. Or, you know, what would be the precursor magazine? I mean, in the Saturday Evening Post, he probably worked there in 1934 when he was the same age.
Right. Exactly. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So weird.
Yeah. He was in the background. In the painting of the Boston Massacre, he's probably in the background.
The Boston Tea Party.
Yeah. We're going to find little Kurt Loders everywhere.
The Last Supper.
Right. Right. Exactly. At the end. Listeners and readers and viewers of Useful Idiots, if you can find Kurt Loder throughout history, let us know, and I think we can agree here. We'll send you a T-shirt. So we had virus, failed coup. What else do we have? Murder, suicide,
licking, food,
licking. So all right. So that thus ends the snarky portion of the show. We have a super interesting interview we're going to do. Long overdue. We're going to take a serious look at the coronavirus problem, and we're going to talk to Dr. Christian Brichot, who is an expert virologist, and who's going to tell us all about the process of identifying diseases and combating them, and all the challenges that lay ahead, and what we can expect in terms of that fight. So it's going to be a super interesting interview, and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Welcome to Useful Idiots, Dr. Christian Brichot, and thank you so much for coming on. So if we could just begin with, you're the president, I believe, of the Global Virus Network. Could you tell us what that is?
Yeah, the Global Virus Network is a network of about 53 research centers all over the world. It's coordinated from Baltimore and also Tampa. I'm also, as I said, a professor at the University of South Florida. And this had been created a few years ago by Bob Gallo, who is a very famous virologist. And it's really about merging the best experts in virology all over the world to really fight against all viruses. Obviously, nowadays, COVID-19 is at the forefront of the fight, but we are really working on all viruses. And you see, the idea is that we need to find new mechanisms to fight against infectious disease. Obviously, in each country, you have research agencies. In the US, you have the NIH, and this is extremely powerful. You have large foundations, such as the Gates Foundation and so on. But we need mechanisms where very rapidly you can get all experts on one topic, working together, collaborating. And this is really what the Global Virus Network is about.
And that was the conception of putting that group together, was to have essentially a kind of rapid response group of experts from around the world.
Right? Exactly. Rapid and collaborative, you see.
Collaborative, and as opposed to competitive, right?
Exactly.
So when you're in a situation like this, and if I understand correctly, your expertise originally was in liver diseases and the hepatology, but for any new contagion that arises, what's the first step? How do you identify what the disease is, and who does that kind of work, and how is it done in this case?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, because actually this is one of the lessons we must take from COVID-19, because we have been insufficient prepared for this. The key for all these infectious diseases is rapid identification by rapid testing, then contact tracing, and then isolation. And for example, in South Korea, in Taiwan, and also to some extent in Germany, they have been able to be very efficient, you see. And then you can really contain an infectious disease. But if you do not succeed to do this because you do not have enough diagnostic testing, because you do not have enough capacities for tracing, for isolating, then you have the spreading, okay? Mm-hmm. And so if you have lost, I would say, the first battle, because you have not been able to limit the spreading, then you have to contain. And this is what has been done in many countries. And this has been efficient. Because you see, a virus is both a very astute organism, mm-hmm. very intelligent in a way, unfortunately, and at the same time, completely dependent on us. Because a virus cannot live by itself.
Right.
So if you contain and if you limit the number of people who can be infected, well, the virus will disappear by itself. So now, obviously, the containment by itself is not sufficient to get the virus disappear, but it has really limited the spread. And what we see now worldwide, in Europe, in the US, in all continents, is that we have been able to contain the spreading of the virus. So now we are coming to the third phase. And then we are in really, I would say, unexplored territories, is how do you relieve a containment?
Mm-hmm.
Because right. you cannot be contained forever. I mean, you have, obviously, economic, but also psychological, sociological consequences, which are enormous. We see this every day. So you have to relax the containment. But at the same time, obviously, what you want to avoid is just to have the second wave and you lose everything and you have to recontain. And for this, it's both simple and complicated. It's just respecting very simple rules. Physical distance, mask, washing the hands, and avoiding large gatherings.
And how do you find out what kind of disease this is? Is it RNA testing, DNA testing? Like, how do you isolate and identify the virus at the beginning of the process? And what does that tell you?
Yeah, nowadays we have technological. We have made some technology progress which are huge. I mean, so you can in a very few days isolate the nucleic acids, DNA or RNA, and you sequence. And you know which virus, which bacteria it is about. And then, in a second step, you can generate antibodies, antibodies detecting serological assays, you see? Mm-hmm. Because you have the sequence of the virus or of the bacteria. Now, just to explain, for the Ebola, for example, that was 2014, 2015, well, it took some time to get the sequence. But this time, I mean, the sequence has been obtained in, 3 days, 4 days, you see?
Right, it was early January.
December, early January.
Yeah.
So we do not have only negative points regarding COVID-19. We also have positive one. You see, we have fantastic progress in technology, in science, but we have to use it for the best of the control of the fight against epidemics. So we have to connect science, surveillance, politics, I would say as a whole, and coordination of politics.
The sequencing can tell us a lot, right? It can tell us how old the disease is, its origins. What did we learn from the sequencing of this disease?
The sequence will tell you about, obviously, the agent, the nature of the agent. Is it DNA and RNA? Does it belong? You see, in this case, the Chinese colleague, they were discovering a new agent. So what is it about? Well, it's a member of the coronavirus family. Okay, mm-hmm. So we know about the previous coronaviruses, you see. So it already provides you a lot of information as to which type of disease we are talking about. Then what you can do is what we call a phylogenetic. In a way, it's a kind of a genealogic tree of where this virus comes from. So you start and you trace. You trace all the infected individuals and you sequence the virus for all of them. And we have a database. So this is great because now we have really a sharing of information. We have a database. They have, I believe, up to 10,000 sequences of viral genomes now all over the world.
Wow.
So you can say, okay, the spreading started there, and then the virus came there, and how it goes. But beyond this, what you really want to understand is how did it start? Where did it come from? And this is how they learned that this virus was very likely now, this is nearly for sure, generated by a recombination between a virus coming from bats with animals such as the famous pangolin,
right,
which which is at the forefront of the conversations, which is a kind of horrible small mammifers that you would never like to eat, but some people eat it.
It's a funny looking animal for sure.
Yeah. And so that's really what this what they learn actually. And now the key question is, do we think that this virus is evolving, you see? Because when you have an RNA virus, this is an RNA virus, when the virus multiplies, the enzyme which drives the replication of the virus, of the viral genome, makes mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So each time you have a new virus, you have just a handful, maybe one or two or three mutations. But they will allow you to pinpoint the difference. Now, this may only be useful, as I said, to trace the virus. But this may have other consequences. For example, could it modify the envelope of the virus? So then, might this impact the efficacy of the future vaccines? You see? Or right. Not. I'm not telling that this is the case, you see, but this is a question you ask yourself.
Right.
And then you have another question. Is it possible that this virus, by evolving, would induce more severe lesions, you see,
mm-hmm.
because of the genetic variability? We do not have evidence so far for this, fortunately. But there has been one report a few days ago, but we have to be very careful, you see, because things need to be verified. But the claim they make is that maybe from the original virus, some strains emerge, which are more contagious,
right.
And they spread to Europe and then to the US, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This has to be confirmed because you see, a problem we have, the good point is that we have a huge effort of the international medical scientific community. I have been the head of a large research institution before coming in the US. I've been the head of the French NIH, of the Institut Pasteur. So I have really witnessed many crises, you see. I have never seen such an effort. So that's very good. Then everybody wants to publish, which is very good because you want to have transparency and publish your data.
Mm-hmm.
But then things go so fast that you have many papers, they have just not been reviewed by experts, you see?
Right.
And they are online. So we have to be careful with the results. We have to be sure that they are verified. But to your point, sequence analysis tells you which virus, gives you an idea of the disease, allows you to trace the virus, and maybe and allows you to ask important questions as to the genetic variability.
Just to follow up on that point about the mutations that were reported a few days ago, I read phrases like deletions may reduce viral fitness. Like, can the mutation make the disease, can it hurt the disease? How would that work out? I mean, I read things like, if it makes it more lethal, it'll actually kill its host faster, and maybe that will reduce the spread. What are they talking about when they use phrases like that?
No, that's so. That's a very. That you see, SARS-CoV-1, the first SARS in 2003, 2004. Okay, very deadly viral infections. Up to 15% of infected patients died. Okay. Ebola virus, up to 60-70% of death. Well, these viruses, they will not propagate so easily because they kill many of their hosts, you see? And if you kill your host, well, you are left without a host to spread. Right. So this is what they mean, you see? Mm-hmm. If you have a virus, now the problem we have with SARS-CoV-2 is that very unfortunately, this is one of the best combination because it is deadly. It does induce death, but not too much, not too much. And it's very contagious. And so this is a situation where you have for the virus all the opportunity to spread. You don't kill too much your host. It's very cynical what I'm telling you. This is a point
rude,
of view of the
guess.
This is a point of view of the virus, you see.
Right. You have to think like it though.
Yeah. Do you think of the virus, like when you're thinking about this or working on it or analyzing it, do you kind of think of it as like a as an analytical being?
Well, that's an interesting point. I frankly, yes, sometimes.
Because it helps you like figure it out,
yeah.
Right?
You see, I mean, viruses have been with us for such a long time. I mean, you see, when we came to Earth, I mean, we had viruses. And many of these viruses, they have been our friends. They have helped us to shape what we are. For example, some retroviruses, we call them, which are present in our genome, they have been very important for women to get pregnant, I mean, to have the placenta and the newborns and so on. And then we have these enemies. So yes, this is maybe because I'm living in the virology all day, but I have a tendency to think to them as a kind of special organisms which want to get rid of us, actually.
Yeah. Right.
Or at least survive, right?
How do you decide whether a virus is a good candidate for a vaccine and what kind of approach are you going to take when you're trying to what are the steps that you have to take at the beginning to try to develop a vaccine?
First, you have to think in a very bold way. Mm-hmm. We have no possibility at the beginning to really bet on a better vaccine process than the others. Now, this may depend on the virus. For example, you have some viruses. They are part of the family of other viruses where we know that efficient vaccines were generated against. Okay? So, logically, you will use the same path to develop the vaccines as the one which were used for the previous one. But this is not the case for coronavirus. So we have to take, and this is a very good point for what is being done. Everything is being tried at the same time. And that's the way to do. We have more than 130 candidates. This is incredible. I mean, it's so hard to follow up even, I mean, to really. But that's very good because we will see which one is the best, you see. Mm-hmm. So you cannot decide. So obviously, each of the group will decide based generally on their experience. I know how to use, missile viruses as a vector. Okay, I will use missile viruses for coronavirus, you see. Mm-hmm. And then I know how to use, how to engineer the envelope protein. Okay, I will engineer the envelope protein of SARS-CoV-2. But at the end of the day, when you look at the overall pictures, you will see coming in all areas. So we will know. We will know soon. And you see, I'm absolutely convinced. And first, we have to be very humble because this virus, I mean, we have been caught by surprise on many things. So what I really keep repeating is that it's good to have experts. It's nice to have scientists and to discuss with them, but they have to be humble, which is important. And then having said that, I really believe that we will have a vaccine, you see. So seems obvious to say it, okay, we will have a vaccine. Yeah, it's anything but obvious because so far on coronavirus, we have had a hard time to get vaccines. But I really believe this. When that become a little bit controversial, because you have announcements, we have the vaccine, we will have next October. At worst, it will be early January. Maybe there is a confusion between, you see, having a first proof of efficacy of a vaccine, which is very good, and having a vaccine that you can use for mass vaccination. And then comes a very important point, which is safety and also the trust from the population. Because there have been a very interesting poll on some, I don't know, not only in France, I believe also in the US, I don't remember exactly where. The question was, oh, are you going to be vaccinated against SARS-CoV-2? Well, you would expect to have 19.99% of positive answers. Not at all. Not at all.
Not in America.
Many people said, oh, no. And you can understand maybe why. So you really have to ensure absolute safety of the product. So then it takes some time. So I really hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong. But if I have to express my opinion, I hardly believe that we could have the vaccine before summer 2021, end of 2021. Some people would disagree with me. And again, I would be very, very happy to be wrong. Very happy. But then you have a very interesting point, which is the following. If you have a vaccine, which is only partly efficient, okay, you know that you cannot control everything, but you can have an effect. Well, then you can use this if you have, for example, new burst of infection somewhere, you see? So it's not a mass vaccination worldwide, but you can use it to control. So that's really an important point. And finally, regarding vaccination, and this is where science presently is really exploding, you can have non-specific stimulation. For example, there are some reports which really suggest, and this makes sense, that BCG therapy, so which is a vaccine against tuberculosis, not only protects against tuberculosis, but induces a kind of bystander effect by protecting against other bacteria or viruses. And actually, there are clinical trials ongoing now in Europe and also in Australia, I believe, where they are testing this possibility. So you see, not only you can have a specific vaccine against the coronavirus, but you can stimulate the protection, our defense mechanisms against the virus. And there is a second orientation that we have been also very much promoting with Bob Gallo in the Global Virus Network is to use polio vaccines, oral polio vaccines. For a number of reasons, I will not go into detail, there is some evidence in other models that it might, again, provide a kind of non-specific stimulation of the defense against the coronavirus. So you see, it goes into so many directions, but this is very positive.
So that idea is the oral polio vaccine might have a kind of secondary effect of increasing the antivirus, the immune response against coronavirus. Yeah. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and possibly also interfering with the viral replication with the SARS-CoV-2 by some mechanisms. Yes, it's very, very interesting. Yeah.
And is that something that's new that you've only discovered in the course of this?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, no, it's this is also where you need the old guys, you see, and you need the memory. It's right. About ancient virological concepts that you bring back with the memory. And you see, this is very interesting. Virology in general and worldwide, virology in general over the next 20, 25 years has been underappreciated. B, for the recruitment of new scientists, I have seen this when I was in my previous positions. I see this in the US. B, on the support. You see, there has been this idea that, of course, yes, we have infectious agents. Yes, of course. But what is important is cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, and so on, which is true. Obviously, I'm not telling that we should forget about this disease. But what COVID-19 reminds us, it says, hey, this is not finished. This is not over. We are there.
Right.
And we can get you.
Yeah.
And this is what we have to remember.
It feels like so much science and medicine is immediately like interconnected with politics, but it seems like virology is even more in some ways than other spheres. How much of your time is spent thinking about politics and the interaction between viruses and politics? Is it even possible to not think about politics in your field of work and
study? I'm trying to think as less as possible on the connection between virology and politics. No, but your point is well taken. And for example, at the University of South Florida, I'm in charge of a task force on COVID-19. And this is really a transdisciplinary aspect where we bring together not only technology, science, but also humanities, behavioral science, and politics. This is why I'm coming to this. And yes, we need to analyze. We need to investigate these interactions because, I mean, you see, after Ebola crisis, we have witnessed a lot of progress in global public health worldwide. The WHO was reorganized in part. We had a new coordination mechanism. So that was very positive. And you see, if we were to have this interview, say, 8 months ago, and you would ask me, do you think that we have made progress in global health over the past year? The answer would be yes, because this is true. And this is why it gets crazy. I mean, at the same time, we have been again caught by surprise on this. So it means that we have to go for politics, but politics in the positive sense of the word. That means how to better harmonize our way to react. You see, the way the countries have been reacting has been, okay, I close my borders. Right. I don't want to think of anybody else. I just want to be reelected. So I have to show to my population that I'm protecting them. Okay? That's a little bit sharp, but that's sure. About true. Okay? And that's not the way to do it. Because you see, Louis Pasteur has been the first to say, okay, sorry, but the viruses, the bacteria, they don't know the borders.
Right. Yeah.
And,
right. It is. It's interesting because I think it can kind of shape consciousness in a way about how we see the world and each other. Because if viruses are international or like transcend nation states and borders, that can affect the way, you know, the decisions of different governments or even just how people see each other.
Absolutely. No, but you see, I mean, we will spend at least 5 to 10 years analyzing what has happened. You see, we have never witnessed how a single virus can disorganize the world. And yes, I mean, and it's about, so for me, politics, you have, obviously, we do have contacts with politics and it's about providing advice, which is very good. And it's about trying to calm down some politicians and so on. But it's also, I mean, more interestingly, I would say, it's really about shaping the future of the way we want to think after this crisis.
Right.
You talked about virology being neglected for do you think that's over? You think it's not going to be neglected anymore? I mean, obviously, you know, when something like HIV happens, suddenly everybody needs virologists, but that problem eventually came under control. But this one has been so serious and so affecting that I would imagine that there's not going to be that kind of neglect again, at least anytime soon, or am I wrong about that?
No, I believe you are absolutely right. Mm-hmm. This will change the way we see. And now it's also, I would say, we need to have what I call the new virology. You see, the new virology is a virology which integrates the old concepts. You see, how do you cultivate a virus? How do you understand some very basic things about virus? But you have to incorporate into the new technologies. We were talking about genome analysis, you see. And then it's about all what is offering the artificial intelligence, contact tracing, and it's about humanity's behavior. So for me, the new virology is a virology where obviously it's about the best experts, finding treatment, finding vaccines, and so on. But integrating the virology, you see, into the whole science. So I'm sure that it would be very different. Yes, I'm really sure.
Were you scared when you heard Trump suggest bleach, injecting bleach, or whatever his theories are? Does that give you, like, does that make your heart beat faster? Or is that something you expect now regularly from Trump? His like new scientific theory of the day, or?
Well, I believe that they have realized that there is a point you should not reach. I mean, I believe that, I don't want to be, provocative and so on, but I believe that you have to be, careful when you speak.
Right. When people, everybody's so desperate to get their lives back to normal, what's the best hope? Is it a vaccine? Is it the disease mutating? Is it the development of some kind of treatment? Or is it a combination of all these things? There's no vector control here, but what should people be putting their hopes in?
Certainly not the vaccine. The vaccine will be there to prevent the new rounds, you see.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that would be very important, obviously, but that's for the future, the way I see it. Mm-hmm. No, you see, you have first to answer really to your question. First, we don't know. You cannot exclude that with the summer. You see, for example, the virus does not like heat, but even more than this, it doesn't like humidity, you see. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Florida, well, we have humidity. So you cannot exclude the fact of this seasonal effect, and that just with the summer, but the problem is summer is here, but it means winter in other continents, you see, so it doesn't solve right. Everything. But you cannot exclude that there will be a seasonal effect which will have a significant impact. Having said that, my hope is the hope I really put on, first, simple people meeting with respecting physical distance, mask, and no gathering, okay? Mm-hmm. That's first. And then treatment. I believe that treatments are really making a lot of progress. And for me, the new challenge, but it is too early, but we have some hints, is preventive treatment. Is it possible to have therapies, which with very little or no side effects, that you can take if you have been in contact with somebody, if you are at risk, you see, of COVID-19. That mm-hmm. would change in everything. So my hope is a combination of seasonal variations, respecting very simple measures, and possibly adding on this all the bulk of treatment. And that would make the bridge with the occurrence of vaccines, which then would allow us to be to prevent all the new rounds over the next years.
Does this, in terms of the socio-political aspect, do you think that this makes the case for something like Medicare for All? And do you have any thoughts on how social distancing should be achieved, whether more through punishment or more through education?
Well, that's
two very tricky questions.
Even for the end.
Specializes in those.
I'm a sneaky virus. You think you got rid of me. And I'm
I would take the second first. It's really, that's a very difficult question because it really depends of the population. For example, in South Korea, people will not react the same as in France, in Italy, or in South America, you see. But in general, I would go for obligatory. And I know that, again, many people would disagree with me, and I may be wrong, but I believe that, you see, that's the only way. To make it, just to explain that this is part of life for a number. Now, regarding Medicare for all, I mean, it depends how you want it. In any case, you see, it advocates for reinforcing the social measures to taking care of individuals. You see, I'm living, obviously, in the US now, and very pleased to do so, but also, obviously, keeping my roots in France, you see. Right. So, two very different systems, you see. And actually, well, this crisis really shows the benefit of the French system, I mean. And when I see in the US so many people in unemployment, I mean, this is heartbreaking, I mean, the way. So I believe I'm not in a position to say, okay, it has to be Medicare for all, but it has anyway, whatever the final mechanisms, it will call for thinking really further on a mechanism to really take care, to better take care of people. That's for sure. And this is what we are learning worldwide.
So more of a safety net.
Yes, exactly.
Less of a safety net, yeah.
Is there anything about this disease that's still surprising or mysterious to scientists at this point? Like, I remember talking to doctors early in this crisis and having them say, you know, it doesn't act like influenza, like it acts like altitude sickness. Yeah. It has a very odd effect on patients. Like they sit in the waiting room and they look fine, but they're hypoxic. Is there something that's still unusual and ununderstood about this disease?
There are many things, and this is incredible. We have to understand exactly what you said. Why do we have this delayed and very sudden respiratory distress in some patients with what we call the cytokine storm? How does it work? Why do we have these neurological disorders? This is incredible. And we don't have time to speak about this, but there is a fantastic hypothesis which has been put forward by French scientists on the use of patch of nicotine to treat COVID-19. I'm not advocating for smoking. I'm advocating for patch of nicotine. So neuroscience, we have just now, I mean, we have coagulation disorders. We have vascular disorders that we do not understand. So this virus has a lot. We have a lot to understand regarding how this virus, the disease that which is induced by this virus. This is just crazy, actually. We are discovering.
Wow, it's fascinating. Yeah. Doctor, thank you so much for coming on. Yeah. I really appreciate it. You've taught us a lot and you've taught our listeners a lot. And we wish you the best of luck as you progress and try to fight this disease.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, very interesting conversation. Yeah.
Thank you. Take care now.
That was amazing. It was
cool,
right?
Super interesting.
I have a theory. I think I know where it comes from. Kurt Loder.
Kurt Lotus is Loder is patient zero?
Yeah. He's like organism zero. He's virus. we think he's ageless. And then when he was talking about like, where does it come from? We have to look into the history, look where it comes from, the genealogical stuff. I was like, I'm not even kidding. I thought of Kurt Loder.
He came out of a Scottish lock.
Yeah, exactly.
In 1175.
Yeah.
And with the virus. That was super interesting. And actually, his demeanor and his positivity is the first optimistic thing I've gotten out of his news cycle.
Yeah, he's very calming. I liked how he does seem to really think of them as little, like, annoying They're almost like frenemies, or frenemies, these viruses. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it was kind of complimentary. Like, you know, they are very smart.
It's true, yeah. I remember the only science I like is when I can, like, imagine, like, the intelligence of these characters. I know that maybe sounds weird, but and I can imagine when I understand the motives.
Well, I mean, it's also a great detective story.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the people like this who are, you know, they're looking at thousands of clues and there's the answer is somewhere in, you know, he's talking about there's 130 candidates. That means that there's all these teams of people who are producing reams of research every single day. And just trying to imagine the intellectual bandwidth that you have to be able to pay attention to all of that and try to put together what's useful over here versus what's useful over here and coming up with a solution out of all of that. I mean, it's a pretty thrilling story. I mean, when all is said and done, when they finally do come up with something for this, it's going to make a great book,
right,
for somebody. Yeah. And it's, you know, fascinating to follow right now.
Yeah, I hope the virus has a good agent. Agent! I didn't even think of that.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for tuning in to Useful Idiots, and we'll see you next week.
Great. And buy the merch. Where can people find merch? Go to Useful Idiots. We have the link in our YouTube videos.
Yep.
We have the links in our podcast also.
Or if you don't want to buy it, find Kurt Loder in an old painting.
Oh, yeah, and then we'll send it to you. Acting as a viral parasite. Yeah.
But it's got to be convincing. I mean, it's not like we're just going to give it to you if it's close. It's got to be him.
Yeah, it's got to actually be photographic evidence of him at the beginning of time.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So we'll give you a t-shirt for that. Good luck.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next week.
The Bigger Pockets portfolio of podcasts are worthy of your investment.
We're having a real conversation as real estate investors.
New episodes available every day.
It's important to buy where it makes money and not necessarily where you want to travel to.
Bigger Pockets, On the Market, Rookie Real Estate, or Money Podcast.
The purpose of flipping is to create more cash so then you can reinvest into other types of properties.
The Bigger Pockets podcast on YouTube or wherever you listen.